Well, good morning. How is everyone? You doing well? Good deal. Thanks for being here today. Looking forward. We're going to continue a series of messages that we started last Sunday entitled Orange, or Orange, if you pronounce it correctly. For those of you who may just be visiting with us today for the first time, let me give you just a little bit of an orientation to where we started our discussion last Sunday, and then kind of get us ready for what I want to share with you this week. So we're exploring this idea of what it means to be an orange church. And where that all begins with is this idea that if you take a family and we think of it as a place of love, that the home is to be this place where moms and dads and husbands and wives and children receive compassion and grace and understanding and affirmation and support and care and protection, all of these things that we associate with this idea of love, then the home should be a place of love. So if you take the image of a heart and you assign it the color red, then we're talking about the family as a place of love. And then we're also talking in this series about the church. And Jesus instructed that the church was to be the light of the world. It was to be an influence on our society for all that is good and right. And so if we take the image of a light bulb and we assign it the color yellow, then what we're talking about in this series is how we bring family and church together. And when you unite both red and yellow, you come with the color orange. Remember that? Okay, so what we're talking about in this series is about a partnership between the family and the church and how we can be of help to each other. And so the long and the short of it is we believe that as a family and as a church working together, we can get a lot more done for all the right reasons or better reasons than we could if we were just out here on our own. So this series is about a partnership between the home and the church for nurturing the faith of our children. And we think this is incredibly important because of the urgency of it all. We only have 936 weeks from the time that your child is born to the time that they become 18 years old and start venturing out very much on their own, creating a path that will be largely influenced by what it is that they learned in those first 936 weeks of their life. So this is really important stuff that we figure out. And it's important for us to have a sense of the urgency of just how little time that we have. I'm now the father of a 23-year-old and an 18-year-old, and I can tell you, it has gone so quickly. It's just absolutely amazing. So here's the deal. When you're aware of how much time you have left, you do more with the time that you have now. And that's what it is that this series is about, is us capitalizing on the wonderful opportunity that we have in these very valuable years in the life of our children. So a couple of lessons that we learned from last Sunday's message, I just want to drive home one more time, and then we'll jump into what we're going to discuss today. The first one is this, that God ordained and empowered parents to be the primary influence in the spiritual lives of their children. Now that's really important that we understand that, that God ordained parents to be the primary influence in the lives of their children, not the church. So for parents to simply bring their children to church and drop them off and expect that the church is going to teach them about God, the church is going to teach them about Jesus, and the church is going to teach them all about the Bible, and the church is going to teach them about faith and how to live their lives in relationship to faith, it's never going to work because God didn't ordain it to work that way. In fact, parents have so much more opportunity to be an influence in the lives of their children. But what we're finding is that many parents aren't comfortable in that situation, don't know exactly how to go about it, aren't comfortable enough in their own faith to be able to pass it on to their children. That's why a partnership can be such a wonderful thing. So we saw two important lessons from last week, is that kids need parents who will help nurture a relationship with God in them. They need that. Otherwise, they're all on their own trying to figure that kind of stuff out. They need some guidance with that. And then what we're discovering is that parents need churches that will help them be the spiritual leaders in their homes. And that's what this series is about, and that's why we refer to Cibolo Creek as an orange church, is building a partnership together with families to help invest in the spiritual future of the lives of our kids. Does that all make sense? So last Sunday, when we were preparing to close the message, I ran a flag up the pole, and I announced that our topic today would be how to have a happy home. And the minute I get the flag up the pole, I sort of get this little nervous feeling in my stomach and I gulp really hard and it's like, oh no, so they're going to show up next Sunday expecting that I'm going to somehow show them everything, teach them everything they need to know about how to have a happy home. And you're going to come in here with certain expectations that Paul's going to give me, like the three secrets or the four keys or the five promises that if you do these things, you will have a happy home. And the truth of the matter is you may go home disappointed today. Because one, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to yank you around. And I'm not going to fill your head with a bunch of plastic platitudes that maybe sound really nice and maybe real inspirational, but they don't really work in real life. I just can't do that. So what we're going to do today is we're going to spend some time looking at some of the really important issues that come to play on what it means to have a happy home. We're going to look at it from a little bit bigger picture, but hopefully by the time we finish today, I can give you four things that I would recommend that you begin with, that you make a special priority for. And if you focus on those four things, they will be really helpful to you in the pursuit of a happy home. Does that make sense? So the best place for me to begin today's discussion is to take a look at what I believe is the absolute best verse in the entire Bible that answers the question of how to have a happy home. Any of you interested in seeing it? All right, I'm going to show it to you, but I have to ask you some questions. Like, are you interested enough in seeing the best verse in the Bible that describes how to have a happy home that you'd be willing to be stretched, maybe think outside some boxes, maybe made to think about some things in a way you've never thought about them before? Are you willing to do that? All right, so here's what I believe is the absolute best verse in the Bible to describe not only how to have a happy home, but how to have a happy life. Here it is. It's found in the book of Proverbs, chapter 24. The book of Proverbs is all about wisdom. So the writer says this: I went past the field of a sluggard. It's a lazy person, an apathetic person, a lackadaisical person. I went past the field of a sluggard, past the vineyard of someone who had no sense. So they were ignorant. Thorns had come up everywhere. The ground was covered with weeds, and the stone wall that had been built around the vineyard, it had all fallen down and was in ruins. Then he makes this observation: I applied my heart to what I observed. I'm looking at this situation, and I applied my heart, and I learned a lesson from what I saw. And here was his lesson: a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, a little twiddling of the thumbs, and poverty will come on you like a thief, and scarcity like an armed man. There it is. Make sense? And some of you are looking at me sort of like, I'm not sure I get how that is the best verse in the Bible about how to have a happy home, and it absolutely is. So let's learn a few lessons from the passage, not about family, not about home, just about the passage. Here's three things that I think are obvious observations. The first one is this: a healthy garden doesn't just happen, but an unhealthy one does. A healthy garden doesn't just happen, but an unhealthy one does. The second lesson is you only get a healthy garden if you do the hard work of gardening. And the third lesson is this: a lazy gardener always wakes up hungry. And you're saying, okay, Paul, I'm still not sure I'm tracking with you here. Because we're not really here to talk about gardening, are we? We're here to talk about how to have a happy home. But that's the nature of a proverb. It's being able to look at life, learn some lessons, and then apply those lessons to the different arenas of your life. We're here to talk about how to have a happy home. So I'll tell you this: A happy home doesn't just happen, but an unhappy one does. You neglect your home long enough, expecting that happiness is going to just somehow magically appear, and you'll be awfully disappointed. Because it's the nature of human dynamics that it'll spiral more toward an unhappy home long before it will ever spiral upward toward a happy one. Second, you only get a happy home if you do the hard work of what it takes to have a happy home. There are certain principles, certain priorities, certain practices that must be observed consistently in order to create an environment where happiness happens. And then thirdly, a lazy gardener, an unengaged parent, an apathetic parent, a disinterested parent will always wake up hungry for the happiness that they long for, because it's just not going to happen by itself. So let's talk a little bit about how that all works in relationship to a happy home. Well, it just doesn't make any sense to me to how to have this discussion unless we talk a little bit about how does happiness work. It's hard to have a happy home if you don't know how happiness works. Now, I'm generally working from the assumption that most of us, we have some sort of an understanding or definition of happiness. They may all be different, but we have a certain idea of what happiness would look like in a home. But do we understand how happiness works? Because if we don't understand how happiness works, then we'll always be left with disappointment and frustration and discontentment. And that won't bring us to a place of experience something that feels and looks like happiness. Does that make sense? So what I want to begin with is I want to talk about the single most important truth that everybody needs to know about happiness. You interested? Okay, to do that, I need to ask you a couple questions, and I'd like to ask you to raise your hand and participate, okay? How many of you are interested in being more fit? You know, lose a few pounds, more and more vitality, okay? It looked like just about everybody. Good. That's very encouraging. How many of you would like to be more successful? Just at what you do, your company, your ambitions, you'd like to be more successful. Again, looks like most people. How many of you are interested in being wealthier? I'm not talking about sick rich. I'm just talking about like having more means to be able to provide for your family, do some things that you've always wanted to do. And then let me ask you this last question. How many of you are interested in happiness? How many of you would like to be happier? Okay, that looks like most hands. Those of you who didn't raise your hand, I'd love to talk with you after the service because we got some issues to figure out. But here's the deal. How absolutely frustrating would it be, and how completely unfair of it for me to say, go be fit. Go on, just go be more successful. Go on, get out of here and go be wealthier. How unfair and frustrating would it be to say, just go be happier. It doesn't work that way, because happiness or wealth or success or fitness, they aren't things that you do. Did you hear that? They aren't things that you do. They are a byproduct. They are a result. They are a return on a certain investment that you make over time. Fitness isn't something that you do. Fitness is a byproduct from a series of things that you do. So what we'd have to do is we'd have to sit down, we'd have to figure out what is fitness, how does it work, and then we'd have to start looking at some of the practices and priorities in your life. And we might have to talk about the foods that you eat and the foods that you don't eat and how much you eat of those foods and when you eat those foods. And we'd have to talk about like how much exercise you're getting or how much activity that you get throughout a day, a week. We'd have to talk about like how much rest you're getting. Because the rest part of fitness is an enormous part of the equation. You're going like, I got that part down, okay, but there has to be the other part. So we have to figure out what would be the particular practices that you'd have to honor when it comes to eating, when it comes to exercise, when it comes to rest. what would be the particular practices that you'd have to do over time? And what I could guarantee you that if you did those certain practices for a certain time, you would eventually discover a greater degree of fitness because it's a byproduct. The same with success. We'd have to figure out what is it that's keeping you from being as successful as you'd like to be. What are some of the key habits? What are some of the key knowledge skills and skills that you'd need to have? So we'd have to figure out, like, maybe it's a time management problem. Maybe it's a project management problem. Maybe it's a lack of a certain skill or a lack of a certain understanding. Maybe it's a networking thing. But here's what I can guarantee you, that if you began honoring the particular practices that are essential to success over time, you will achieve a greater degree of success. Same with wealth. And the same with happiness. Happiness doesn't just happen. Happiness is a byproduct of a certain set of principles applied consistently, priorities honored consistently, and a certain set of practices that essentially become habits in our life that we do again and again and again, and in time, we reap a garden, a harvest, of the happiness that we long for. That's absolutely essential to understand. Happy is a byproduct of consistently honoring the essential practices of a healthy life. You see, folks, when we go into the equation just expecting that happiness is going to happen, and it doesn't just show up, and we have drama in our family, we have conflict in our family, we have tension in our family, and we're like, oh no, my family's falling apart, we're not happy. No, that has nothing to do with happiness. In fact, that conflict, that tension, that stuff that needs to be managed, that's part of how we become a happier family, is working through those sorts of things. But when we just expect happiness to show up in a marriage, or just show up in a home, we're always going to feel frustrated and disappointed and eventually disillusioned, and we're going to give up. So here's a couple of things that I'm going to tell you truthfully about how happiness works. Some things that you need to understand about fitness, about wealth building, about success, and certainly about happiness. And the first one is this: it's not easy. It takes an enormous amount of work. I mean, think about fitness, particularly if you're like really out of shape and you make like the New Year's resolution, I'm going to lose 40 pounds and I'm going to run a 5K. Okay, how easy is that? It's not easy. And there's a million excuses that you'll come up with by why you shouldn't have to do that work. It's too early, it's too late, it's too hot, it's too cold, it's too rainy, it's too windy. I'm too sore, all right? And so we talk ourselves out of it, but we have to do the work if we hope to make the progress. It's not easy. And the same is true with building a happy home. It's not easy. It takes an enormous amount of work. And there's 100 different obstacles to have to navigate in order to preserve the practices that it takes in order to enjoy happiness. The second thing is, it will not happen quickly. Happiness is a marathon, not a sprint. It's something that we do over time, abiding by certain priorities and practices that eventually the seeds that we plant when they're 3 and 4 and 5 start to sprout when they're 12 and 13 and 14. But it won't happen overnight. Fitness doesn't happen overnight. Oh, I know that. It does not happen overnight. Wealth does not happen overnight. Success does not happen overnight. The same is true with happiness. And finally, it requires consistency. We must consistently honor those essential practices that create happiness. But here's what I see in so many families. I've even seen it in my family at times. We come to a workshop or we read a book, we come to a series of messages at church, and we're talking about a family, and we're learning all these things, and we get all kind of jacked up, and we think, okay, we're going to make our family better, and we're going to pursue happiness harder, and we're going to do these things, and we do these things that we really think we should for about 2 weeks, maybe 2 months, and then life starts happening again, and starts getting in the way, and we stop doing those things that we committed to, and then the next thing you know, it's been 2 and 3 and 4 years, and we're not honoring those habits anymore. We're not honoring those priorities until what happens? the next crisis. Pretty soon our kids won't talk to us anymore and we can't get them to do anything that we ask them to do. Or there's some sort of an issue at school. And what do? We get scared and it becomes urgent again. We run back and we say, oh, that's right. We're supposed to be doing these things and we just need to get back to that. But unless it's consistently done, can keep jumping back and forth, it'll never produce the results that we're looking for. It has to be consistent. Can I teach you a different word? I mean, I know I like the word happiness. Happiness is a good word. It's just that it's a bit unrealistic. Because the word happiness in most people's mind, it has a persona. And the persona is that happy means that we're always smiling, we're always laughing, we're always having a good time, everything's going perfectly. That's happiness. And so we get really like disillusioned and disappointed when everything's not happy in our home. Not everyone's smiling and not everyone's laughing. We're not always having a good time. I think there's a better word. And that is the word healthy. You see, in our longing for happiness, what we're really searching for is healthy. A healthy marriage. A healthy relationship with teenagers. A healthy home in how we all get along. Healthy is so much more sustainable and so much more realistic to the way that life works. You see, it's in healthy that when we have tension or we have conflict, we pursue resolution in a healthy kind of manner. But if it's always about happy and everybody's not smiling and laughing, then we get alarmed that our family's not working, and that's not the truth. But if we think more in terms of healthy, we go about it differently and we go about it in a way that's going to last us much longer. So here's what I'd like to tell you. A healthy home is a happy home. You see, this is the hard work. The hard work of pursuing those things that keep us healthy, done consistently, they will create the byproduct of happiness that we all long for. And then just pick your topic. Healthy relationships. What does a healthy relationship look like between a husband and wife? What does a healthy relationship look like between a father and his 16-year-old? What does a healthy relationship look like? You ready? I'm not trying to be snarky. This is an enormously complicated issue in too many homes. What does a healthy relationship look like with a mom and her kids? There are so many unhealthy relationships with moms waiting on kids hand and foot, protecting them from all of the evils of life, and it's not helping kids grow up with the capacity and the capabilities of handling life on their own. What do healthy boundaries look like? Healthy routines that nurture togetherness. What's healthy lines of authority? What does that look like in a home? How can a home be led without it being a dictatorship? What does healthy authority look like? Healthy influences in the life of the home, like really looking at, I'm not trying to sound Baptist here, but what does it look like? What are we watching on television? What are we looking at in the content of video games? What kind of magazines are we reading? What kinds of social media are we following? These influences have an enormous impact on the happy equation in our home. Healthy finances. Folks, we cannot underestimate the power of stress, fear, and concern over finances and its impact on the dynamics of a family. When mom and dad are all sideways financially, spending a lot more money than they actually have, and they live in that fear and that panic of making enough to be able to get through the month and pay off their credit card and afford this house that they really can't afford and afford these cars that we really can't afford, all of that tension, all of that poison eventually seeps down into a relationship with the family as a whole. That's why we have to have a healthy understanding of how finances work. Just take your pick. Healthy is a better word than happy because it's a lot more realistic and a lot more sustainable. Does that make sense? So here's the question. Are you willing to do what it takes to have a happy home as badly as you want a happy home? Because happiness doesn't just happen. It is a byproduct. It is the result or the return on a series of priorities, a series of principles, and a series of practices that we do consistently over time. And then the garden grows. And we enjoy the happiness that we all long for. Make sense? Okay, so speaking of priorities, let me share with you what I think are four of the most important building blocks to a happy home. I'm going to give you four words, then we're going to explain them. And here's the deal. This isn't going to be particularly sexy, all right? But this is very significant. In fact, I'm going to say this. You look at these four words, and you decide immediately, oh, I'm not interested in that. I don't get that, so I don't even want to learn more about it. Then you just need to understand to ignore these four words is to say, I'm not really interested in having a happy home. These words are non-negotiable, indisputable. Not because I say it, because God established them as being the way the universe works. It's like gravity. You can say, I'm not interested in gravity, but you will always be brought back to the harsh reality that gravity always works. And these four words are absolutely essential to a happy home. You interested? Still with me? All right, I still got some more time. All right, watch this. Design, wisdom, discipline. That's not the discipline you're thinking about. That's not punishment. That's about the consistent application of the right things and humility. Ignore those four words and forsake happiness every single time. So let's talk about them real quickly. Design. Design is about honoring the way that God ordained life to work. See, what we need to understand is that God, the creator of the universe and the creator of human life, he established a certain pattern to the way things work. Try as hard as we might to change the pattern. We don't agree with the pattern. We don't like the pattern. The pattern is no longer popular. Doesn't matter. It's God's pattern. He's established it for the way that it works, and God's not interested in being popular. So God has established. So it's interesting. God has established several things for a particular design and a particular purpose. If you read through the Bible, you'll actually find that there's five of them. Five entities, five institutions, whatever word you want to use. Five entities that God created for how the universe was designed to work. And these five things were created with divine design, and each of them carries blessing. And here's what I mean by that. If we follow the design, if we honor the design, then there is a blessing on our life for living in connection with that particular design. Does that make sense? So here they are. Israel, government, work, family, and church. So just real quickly, God established the nation of Israel, the Jewish people, for a divine purpose. And when the nation of Israel lives in relationship to their divine purpose, then God promised them blessing. And it gets even better than that. Throughout the scriptures, we're taught that when other nations, when other people honor the design of God for the nation of Israel, then they too are blessed because the divine carries blessing, the divine design. Government, don't think of today's politics. God established that people groups were to be led according to a certain design. And when people submit to the guidance and the protection of a government that works according to God's design, there is blessing for them. Some of the whirlwind that the United States is reaping right now is because we're trying to do this in a way that is not in keeping with God's design. And we're reaping the harvest of that. Work. God established work as having a divine design. It has a purpose in human life. And when we honor that design, we know blessing. But the two that I'm most interested in this morning is that God established family, marriage and family, both having a divine design that comes with blessing. When you and I honor the design that God created for marriage and for family, then we are the recipients of the blessings that come with that design. If we ignore that design, we shouldn't be surprised that we don't know the blessing. And folks, I don't have to tell this group. We're living in a culture right now, we're living in a society that's working overtime to destroy everything about God's design in relationship to family. We're redefining everything from marriage to morality to gender. And all I can say is God designed it to work a certain way. And regardless of what the majority might think or vote, if it's contrary to God's design, it will not work. It will not afford the blessing, the happiness that people long for in trying to change the design. And then finally, God established the church as having a divine purpose in the world. And when we live in relationship to that divine purpose, there is blessing. So you want to be stretched? You say, could you just tell me first and then I'll let you know? Okay, here's the deal. In each of these designs that God established and ordained to work a certain way, and the blessing that comes through them, there is a very important principle. I call it the authority submission principle. Now, this is hard for Texans, because we don't do well with the word submission. But God established that if you live up under in submission to my design, then you will know the blessing that comes with it. But if you pull yourself out from under the design and say, no, I'm not going to do marriage that way. No, I'm not going to do family that way. No, I'm not going to raise my kids the way that God designed, then we pull out from under the opportunity of the blessing that comes with that particular design. And why is this important? Because ultimately, it's all about our faith. You see, when we submit ourselves to God's design for marriage, when we submit ourselves to God's design for family, and we submit ourselves to God's design for church, what we're saying is, God, I trust you. I trust that you know better than I do. I trust that you see and understand things that I'll never comprehend. So in faith, I'm going to align myself in submission to your design for my marriage. In faith, I'm going to align myself to your design for our family. In faith, I'm going to align myself to your design for the church. But when we say, God, no, I'm not going to do it the way that you design, we're essentially turning our back to God and saying, thank you, but no thank you. I'll do this my way, my terms, my agenda, my priorities. And the whole time, God as a loving Heavenly Father is standing there and saying, okay, go have your way, but I don't want to be the father who's the one who says, I told you so. Because you'll get out there so far and you'll learn the hard way, maybe before it's too late, but you'll learn the hard way that my design was better and that it comes with blessing. And the thing that you went off looking for that you thought you could do better wasn't blessing at all. And folks, our nation and our community and our churches are full of this sort of backwash because people refuse to live up under the design that God has established for how marriage and family was intended to work. Does that make sense? All right, so here's just one of the designs, just one example. The book of Ephesians, Paul's letter to the church at Ephesus. If you get time this afternoon, read verses chapter 5, verses 22 through 33. Excellent passage on God's design for marriage. He sums up his discussion. He says, each one of you who are married, each one of you must love his wife as he loves himself. That same diligence, that same sense of urgency, that same sense of priority, you must love your wife with that same kind of intensity as you typically move to love yourself. And the wife must respect her husband. I'm not going to respect him. Not with what he's done, not with what he does. Okay, that's a problem. That's an issue when a husband is behaving in a way that's not respectable. But for us to not address that and to simply exist in that sort of tension, that sort of separation, I'm not going to respect him. I'm not going to love her like she deserves. When we live outside of the design, we shouldn't be surprised that our marriage doesn't experience the blessing of happiness that God has for it. And we live in the tension, and we live in the turmoil, and we live in the disappointment. And so often that becomes so great, we end up just going separate ways, and we miss out on the opportunity that God had in the design the whole time. Okay, we're going to move on. Second thing. Wisdom. We have to understand the priority of design and live in relationship to it, and we have to understand wisdom. Applying the lessons that you learn to the choices that you make. That's what that passage in Proverbs 24 was all about, is looking at the way that life works, learning lessons, and then applying them to your choices. So it's interesting, as a pastor, from time to time, you know, somebody will come and, hey, could I have a meeting with you? Could I make an appointment? Absolutely. We'll get together and we'll be sitting down and they'll start talking about some of the mess that they're in. And they're asking me for some guidance and some advice. And so I sort of listen to their story and I make a couple observations and draw some, you know, conclusions with the little bit of information I have. And so I'll say to them, well, let me give you three or four things that I might suggest that you do to sort of begin working your way out of this mess. And sometimes, this doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes, when they don't like what I'm telling them, they cop a little bit of an attitude, and it goes something like this. Well, you're telling me I'm supposed to do that? And I'll say, well, I'm recommending, I'm suggesting it. And they'll say, give me a chapter and a verse. I'll go, give you a chapter and a verse for what? These things that you're telling me, give me a chapter and a verse in the Bible that why I should do that. And I'll say, I can't give you a chapter and a verse. And they'll say, well, then I don't really have to do it because it's not in the Bible. Okay. I'll say, well, let me ask you a couple other questions. Would you ever put marbles down your garbage disposal? No, that would ruin the entire mechanism. Would you ever put maple syrup in the oil reservoir of your BMW? No, it would ruin the engine. Would you ever snack on rat poison? No. I go, you know what? There's not a chapter and verse in the Bible about any of that. You see, that's called wisdom. Wisdom is learning about the way that life works, letting other people make the mistakes so that you don't have to, but learning those lessons and applying them to the choices you make. Now, why is that important? Because in the course of a marriage and in the course of raising children, you're going to encounter literally millions of different scenarios and situations where there isn't a chapter and a verse to tell you what to do. You have to start collecting a body of truth from books that you read, from people that you talk to, from experiences that you have, and most importantly, from the wisdom of the scriptures to inform your heart and your mind so that you end up making choices that are in fact wise in very difficult situations that seem to be changing almost every day. That's why the very first verses of the book of Proverbs read like this. These are the proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, for gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right, doing what is just, doing what is fair, what every parent longs for giving prudence to those who don't know what to do, knowledge and discretion to the young, to the inexperienced. Let the wise person listen. Let them add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance for understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. And then here is the first and most important proverb. The fear of the Lord, a deep and abiding respect for God, is the beginning of knowledge. It's where it all starts. But fools despise wisdom and they push away instruction. When a parent decides that they have it all figured out, that they know best, that they're not open to reading that book or going to that seminar or getting that counseling because nobody's going to tell them what to do, then you need to understand that that is foolish. And it'll never produce the kind of wisdom or the kind of happiness that you long for in your home. All right, we got to move on quickly. Third thing that is absolutely essential building block is discipline. Again, I'm not talking about corrective punishment. I'm talking about the consistent honoring of healthy habits. Remember priorities, remember principles, remember practices. Remember that? This is just a few minutes ago. Remember those three words? Every one of us, we have to choose a couple of those key principles, a couple of those key priorities, a couple of those key practices that we believe will contribute to the health of our home and then consistently honor them. Regardless of what age the kids are, regardless of what season of life we're in, regardless of how much turmoil may be going on in our world, we have to apply a consistent pattern of behavior in order to create a secure environment in our home for our kids to thrive. Charlotte and I, years ago, when we were just starting our family, we decided on one particular discipline. This is just one of several, but one particular discipline was that we would always have an evening meal together as a family. That we would always sit down and we would always enjoy supper together. And the second part of that rule was that we'd all be at the table together every night of the week and no cell phones were invited. It didn't matter if it buzzed or beeped or chimed or anything, you couldn't address it. It was just time for us to center our lives around each other and catch up with one another and connect with one another. Now, were there exceptions? Sure. I had meetings. The boys had athletic things or other school events to be at. There were exceptions, but we consistently decided that we would always sit down together as a family and eat supper. And I can tell you that has paid off enormous dividends for us time and time again in the life of our family. Last one, very quickly, humility. It's a non-negotiable. Humility is the attitude of a husband, and the attitude of a wife, and the attitude of a father, and the attitude of a mother, attitude of children, meaning we're always open to learn more, we're always open to accept help, and we're always open to extending grace because we don't have it all figured out, and we don't always know what to do, and so we're going to be gracious in our role as husband and wife. We're going to be gracious in our role as moms and dads. We're going to teach our children how to be gracious to one another and to us. Because humility is everything in the dynamics of a healthy home. And let me just say this very quickly. If you're sitting here and you're saying, oh man, we got messes, we got things to fix, we got drama happening here, I don't know how we're ever going to navigate, but I'm not going to go to counseling, you need to know that that's arrogance. Your stubborn refusal to go and get some help about a pattern of behavior that's creating destruction in your home is simply an arrogance that nobody's going to tell you what to do or tell you to do anything different. But it's the spirit of humility that looks at something that's dysfunctional in the way that your marriage is working or destructive in the way that your home is happening and to say, we need to get some help and I'll be the first one to lead out to make sure that we get it. That could be reading a book or going to a workshop or getting some help from somebody who's a specialist in trying to figure out those situations. Make sense? Okay, now we got to go really fast, really, really fast. Here's four things that I think absolutely essential to a healthy home. You'd be wise to start them as soon as you leave here in this room if they're not currently happening in your house. The first one is this. A healthy reverence for God and a deep devotion to Jesus Christ. Now, I know you're thinking, well, you're the preacher, you're supposed to say that. Well, then I guess I'll be the preacher and I'm supposed to say that because I absolutely believe it. You see, folks, if marriage is a divine design made by God, if family is a divine design made by God, then I would be wise to get to know the designer really, really well so that I can listen to his lead in my life to know what he wants me to do in relationship to the design. Look at this passage of scripture. Unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand and watch in vain. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. And God has an enormous wealth of wisdom that he wants to share with us if we'll give him that place in our life. So let me say something to everyone in the room honestly. And by experience, I'll say this specifically. I want to speak directly to men, although this is for everybody. And it's this. You have to make a choice about just how seriously you're going to take your faith. There has to come a place in your life someday where you just decide, I'm in. I'm going to make a stand. I am a follower of Jesus Christ, and I will deeply respect God's place in my life, and I will set that example for my family. Too many men abdicate the spiritual leadership of their family to their wives because their wives will be humble enough to pursue the help of God. Husbands, it's time to step up. Take God seriously. A casual faith, hit and miss, now and then, if it's convenient, a casual faith never produces serious results. So I'll say this. Dabbling around with your faith in God isn't helping your family one bit, and especially your children, because you're creating a confusing example for them. What happens in a home where a father will not take his faith seriously, and he's hit and miss every once in a while, is that he's setting an example in those 936 weeks that he has with his son or his daughter, and they're learning from you. And what I see what happens consistently, without fail, very rare exceptions, is that somewhere around the age of 16 and 17 and 18, and certainly when they head off to college or the military or their career, they look back on those 936 weeks and they say, well, it was never important to my dad. It was never a priority for my dad. My parents never took it seriously, so I'm not going to either. And we are reaping the whirlwind of the results of that sort of pattern that's been established in far too many homes. Mom and dad, it's time to step up to the importance of your faith in God and your devotion to Jesus Christ for the good of your family. Next, highly recommend a healthy relationship between mom and dad. I'll just say it this way. The single most important factor to a happy home is a father and mother with a healthy marriage. You can't begin to understand the enormous impact of tension and dysfunction between a mom and a dad and its implications on their home. All right? A healthy approach to conflict resolution. Folks, we have to figure this out. How do we resolve conflict other than yelling and screaming and belittling and intimidating and powering up? We have to figure out how does a family talk through difficult discussions and difficult dilemmas in ways that are constructive and healthy in order to create happiness in our home. And then finally, I'd say this, a healthy priority for time together. It is absolutely essential that moms and dads are setting the example and establishing the priority that we as a family are going to spend time together. And I'll just say this completely honest to you. Mom and dad, it's time to stop letting the kids make that agenda for us. It's time to stop letting their whining about what you chose to do as some sort of boycott on the priority of togetherness. And it's time, draw the line that of the million things we've got our kids involved in, there is no time for us to just be together. Parents need to step out and say, no more. for the good of our home and the happiness in it, we are going to limit the enormous number of things that we're committed to so that there is time to be together. Make sense? You know how I'm feeling right now? I feel like I'm driving this truck backwards and it's going beep, 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 and this bed is just going up and about dumping all of this information on you. But I just believe this stuff is so important, and it's so different than just plastic platitudes to send you home. This is reality. And I believe that everything that we discussed today is really important. So if you're feeling a little overwhelmed, we want to give you a gift, just a minute or two. I'm going to ask the band to come. We're going to conclude our service with a song. I just you'd want to take a breath. I just want you to receive God's grace that regardless of the messes that you've made or the things that you're embroiled in right now, and it's that God's grace is sufficient. And if we honor his design, we can know that blessing if we'll just get back to the things that are most important. We're going to sing a song together that refreshes our soul with the idea that Jesus really is enough for our lives if we'll just listen to him. Let me pray for you, and we'll enjoy this song together. Father, thank you for your enormous grace. Thank you most of all for your incredible wisdom and the grace that allowed you to share your wisdom with us. Father, may we be the kind of people who honor your designs so that we are the kind of people who experience your blessings. Meet with us now in this song, I pray and ask in Christ's name. Amen.
Great the chasm that lay between us. How high the mountain I could not climb. In desperation I turned to heaven and spoke your name into the night. Then through the darkness your loving kindness tore through the shadows of my soul. The work is finished, the end is written. Jesus Christ, my living hope. Who could imagine so great a mercy? What heart could fathom such boundless grace? The God of ages stepped down from glory to wear my sin and bear my shame. The cross has spoken, I am forgiven. The King of Kings calls me his own. Beautiful Savior, I'm yours forever. Jesus Christ, my living hope. Hallelujah, praise the one who set me free. Death has lost its grip on me. You have broken every chain. There's salvation in your name. Jesus Christ, my living hope. Hallelujah. Praise the one who set me free. Hallelujah. Death has lost its grip on me. Salvation in your name, Jesus Christ, my living hope. Then came the morning that sealed the promise. Your buried body began to breathe. Out of the silence, the roaring lion declared, the grave has no claim on me. Would you sing that again? Then came the morning that sealed the promise. Your buried body began to breathe. Out of the silence, the roaring lion declared, the grave has no claim on me. Jesus, yours is the
Awesome. Well, we're so glad you guys were here this morning. We're so glad you worship with us. You guys are dismissed. We'll see you next time.